We get back to gold.
Right. Well, you were speaking too of the sort of the emotional power of gold that seems to reach across the national.
Well, I think it's the one commodity that, in a sense, in a very real sense, gives the world a common money. Mm-hmm. And as such, it reaches into the socialistic countries too, mm-hmm. into Russia and into China. If the world is ever going to have a common money, it seems to me the only basis for it today would be gold. Certainly, the world is not going to accept the dollar as their common money. De Gaulle wouldn't, but I'm sure the rest of the Europeans wouldn't either, in final analysis. And the reason the dollar for a time was very nearly the world's common money was that it was redeemable in gold. And now we've abused the dollar to such an extent that the claims in dollars against our gold are now pretty nearly four times the quantity of gold we have. So naturally, the Europeans are a bit skeptical about the ability to redeem the dollar in gold. So I think the dollar has lost its prestige and status as the world money. Hasn't yet, but it's on its way. So I think the one thing that could be a common money is gold, and I don't see why the people who are really competent, knowledgeable people about money don't utilize gold effectively.
What is the, in your view, what is the strongest argument that they put forward for not using gold as the...
One argument has been that there, and you brought it up a little while back, there isn't enough gold to go around. Well, there isn't at $35 an ounce. Whether there would be at 70 is perhaps doubtful, but I don't think so. I think 70 would pull gold out of hoards, and I think we'd have another two or three decades when we could have quite a stabilized, sound money with gold at $70 an ounce. There are some people who argue it would have to be valued much higher than $70, but I think 70 would hold, because I do think that there would be not only a good flow from the mines, but a flow out of hoards.
Then do I interpret this correctly, that you feel that hoards are basically non-productive and it's a good thing to decrease hoards?
I think in a sense they're basically non-productive, except to the extent that a hoard has protected a man's wealth. That is, the Frenchman in 1914, who had a nice, comfortable position of a pension and insurance, and his old age looked after in francs in 1914, still has those francs. And what are they worth? Fraction of a cent. And if he'd taken those francs and sold them, say in the spring of 1914, and buried that gold in the garden and have it today, he would have preserved his wealth.
Can you spend little pieces of gold now? I mean, are they...
The Frenchman can. No, it's legal.
He
now could dig up his gold and spend it. And an extraordinary thing today is the great difference in value of gold coins over gold bullion. That is if you now can own some of our gold coins, like the $20 gold piece and the $10 gold pieces and those, because they're regarded as collector's items, no more are being made, but you go out and try to buy them, you'll be paying quite considerably over $70 an ounce. And even silver. There are practically no silver dollar coins available for less than around $3 if you try to buy any of those on the market today.
Mm-hmm.
shows how Gresham's law works.
Yes, yes, it does.
The French every day there's a quotation for various coins in European markets, and the rate, the price of gold in those coins is practically always quite a bit higher than the price of gold in bullion on the markets. I wish we could strike medallions and pay our dividends. I'd even put Roosevelt's head on one with a halo called Redeemers, I think.
Coming out of home stake, that would really be elegant, wouldn't it?
That would be illegal. In fact, we can't even put out commemorative medallions. Though we might be able to get permission to do that. That would be rather nice.
With Arthur Burns on the other side, you might.
Well, he doesn't have to say it. I don't think the Federal Reserve Bank would get into that problem. That's up to the Treasury. But we really operate under Treasury regulations.
I see.
Based on the laws of 34 and 35.
Mm-hmm. Does there seem to be in prospect any change in the laws that you're able to determine?
I see very little chance. We would like to have the restrictions on ownership of gold removed, and I think we have to make a perfectly good logical argument for that. Mm-hmm. In which case, the American citizen would have the right to buy and hold gold if he wanted, besides owning it in jewelry. Mm-hmm. If you go into Tiffany's and buy a gold necklace, you'll find you're paying a price of gold way, way above $70 an ounce. Of course, they say that's the workmanship. Nevertheless, it's a terrifically high price.
When you speak of gold as a commodity base for a monetary system, the alternative is fiat money. Is that
yes.
the meaning of it?
And by fiat money, I mean that it's money by authority of the government. For example, if I owe you $100, and I give you $100 bill, I have legally paid my debt, whether you want to accept it or not. If I offer it to you and you don't accept it, well, I've paid my debt. If you won't take it, I wouldn't be legally held responsible. I've given you that. And if you look, the bills used to say that they are redeemable in lawful money at any reserve bank or the treasury. Now, lawful money under the Constitution is gold and silver, but the Treasury will give you another dollar bill. Well, now they've taken, and this has been done without anybody noticing it, they've taken off that statement, redeemable in lawful money, is now said this is legal tender in payment of all debts, public and private. Now that is what is fiat money.
I see. Now, you were saying that gold and silver is defined in the Constitution.
Yes, and the old bills, may find some of your old bills. I don't know whether...
Let's see if I have one, just for fun, to see what we have.
I think they just... I kept one, the last one I found. Now, this note is legal tender for...
Yes, this says legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Now that, you'll find very few of them. The bills of 5 or 6 years ago had a statement that it was redeemable in lawful money. And that was getting embarrassing.
So the difference between lawful money and legal tender.
It's a very definite distinction. And some suits have been brought to challenge the legality of this, but they've always been dismissed one way or the other.
Does being on the gold standard or not being on the gold standard have any effect on stock market performance, that is the fluctuation that we are seeing now?
Well, only I think if you were on a gold standard, with the control over inflation that that would give, that I think that would have a tendency to subdue the violence of the fluctuations on the market. I think it would restrain some of the excesses. I don't think it would eliminate them. And even with a gold standard, as some wise banker said the other day, the monetary system is only as good as the people who are running it. But under a gold standard, abuses could grow up, and if those abuses became too severe, either the power of the gold standard itself would correct the abuses, or the gold standard would be thrown overboard, just the way it was in the Big Depression and the way England had to do after the wars.
Well, you've given us a good statement of the virtues of the gold standard. Would you be willing to give the other side, that is, the possible misuses of the gold standard?
I think that's a side I probably don't dwell upon very much.
All right.
But the if you had a period of Great Depression, unemployment, and a time when a government wanted to spend money very freely, and the gold standard was restraining it, the people would have to submit to some measures of discipline.
Wage and price control?
They'd have to have, wages would have to come down, prices would have to come down. I think you could imagine a perfectly prosperous economy with falling prices and wages mm-hmm. and prices both went down together.
Yes.
That is, the long period following the Civil War, there were periods of great expansion and prosperity in the United States, and by and large, it was a period of falling prices. Mm-hmm. But we've somehow or other seemed to tie rising prices and prosperity together.
Yes.
Which doesn't make sense, and yet that's the way everybody thinks. I think you could have falling prices and prosperity also.
So it's the relationship.
Yes. But I think in all these things that there are so many variables that wages go up, prices go up. Wages go down, prices go down, but they don't move evenly. And some one or the other of the social groups gets great benefits at the expense of somebody else.
Is it possible to get a better meshing without controlling the economy rather closely?
I don't see how they can do it. I really have getting more and more skeptical about the ability of these theorists in among economists and bankers who think they can really fine-tune economies. And there's such wide divergence of opinion. And one group gets in the saddle, and they all go in one direction. Another group gets in and goes in another direction. And I just don't think they know what they're doing.
How would you characterize the present policy?
Well, the present policy, as I see it, is dominated by the thought that interest rates will be high, the economy will be slowed down, and there will be less expenditures for new plants and things of that sort, and the inflationary tendencies will be checked, and prices will level off and start down again. Well, that's a theory, but it isn't working out in practice. And I think there may be some fundamental fallacies in it. If you check the growth in the gross national product, there are less goods, and people sitting with more money are going to buy them, your prices will tend to go up.
And isn't it difficult to pursue this concept while there is a war?
Well, in a war, all bets are off.
I see.
It seems to me that when a country is, of course, a war like Vietnam is that's not a national, our national existence isn't threatened. But in a war where your national existence is threatened, and you are faced with the possibility of defeat, there all rules are off. And under those circumstances, why the dominant government simply finances it with paper money. You've got to take it. Mm-hmm. That's, and of course, during a war, you can have price controls, wage controls, and so on enforced. Mm-hmm. And temporarily, those will hold prices down. Well, in the war, you couldn't buy things, you know. The market, the things were not on the market. So, in that time, the people who are getting pretty good wages were putting a whale of a lot of money into savings accounts. This paper money was accumulating as a great flood, and then afterwards all that buying power came out and up in prices. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'll pay the price in the end with severe inflation. And I really think that after every great disaster, such as a world war, you'll have to have a revision of the currencies. And if they're going to still stay on gold, it would be an increase in the price of gold in relation to those currencies, or a revaluation of gold in terms of those currencies, if we're going to try to get back into a proper equilibrium. And if gold is, you attempt to hold gold at the old price, everybody would like to have gold rather than paper. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we don't allow people to have gold. But there'd be a great rush to it if we did.
Yes, it certainly would.
Yeah.
Just thinking a moment of some of the areas of the world in which you have done some geological work, is there gold still in Alaska that is, let's say, profitable to mine at the present price?
There's very little that is profitable to mine in Alaska. The last profitable operations, and some, there may be a few still going on, are the gold dredging operations, where gold, detrital gold in great gravel deposits is mined by a dredge which floats on a lake and digs out a bank on one side and washes the gravels, gets the gold out, and dumps the barren gravel behind them, and travels right along, eating up the gravels in the valley. And you can mine and make money out of very low-grade deposits that way. But for a long time, there have been no really important discoveries of new mines in Alaska. But it's a tremendous area, and I think there's a good chance there will be new mines discovered, but there's been very little prospecting for gold because everybody's been so pessimistic about making any money out of it. And the rate of new development of new mines in Canada has been very slow. I'm sure there will be more mines found in that great expanse of the North Woods of Canada. Mm-hmm. But it takes enthusiastic prospectors, and there's not much enthusiasm for prospecting for gold right now.
Do you think the day of the amateur prospector is past? Is it now in the hands?
Well, not entirely, but pretty largely. But prospecting today is a highly organized thing, where you send in expeditions. There's geological mapping done, and then there's geophysical work, that is measuring electrical conductivity and measuring magnetic conductivity, and most wonderful new techniques. No one of them leads right to the target, but all combined rather indicate areas which are more favorable than others. And then there will be groundwork. You'll have to go in for final analysis and do diamond drilling. Now, those techniques don't work so well with gold. Well, you have to do it rather indirectly. That is, the minerals that are associated with gold may lead you in, but gold is so scarce that it doesn't reveal itself by those techniques. But you may get enough evidence to say, well, this is a good country to drill. These techniques work much more in connection with copper and nickel and things of that sort. There are great traverses made by flying with electrical and magnetic equipment. And registering what we call the anomalies in the Earth, the variations in the Earth's magnetic field, the variations in the electrical field, and so on. But the big companies are spending millions and millions in that type of work. It's not a small man's job. But in Canada, in the last few years, there was, from flying, followed up by groundwork, and a number of very important deposits have been found, one by the Texas Gulf Sulphur, a big mine of copper and zinc, lead, zinc, some copper, silver, that is now in production. The International Nickel Company in the last 15 years developed a new great district in Manitoba, which was really a combination of geophysical and ground geology, and then diamond drilling. But it cost millions to find it.
Excuse me, is International Nickel one that you are still associated with?
Yes, I'm on the...
Are you on the board?
Been elected again for another 2 years on the board. That makes me one of the oldest members on the board.
Well, that's tremendously complimentary.
It was. I was very flattered. They asked me to continue to act as their consulting geologist, so I've been having a lovely time. I shouldn't be doing that in my own position, but I can't resist it.
Oh, of course. Oh, that's fascinating. You've spoken a couple of times of diamond drilling. Is this taking a core?
Yes, the diamond drill is an old tool. It's gradually becoming more and more perfected more and more. And it's essentially a ring, an annular ring set with either diamond dust or small diamonds, and then there's a device to rotate it and to bore into the earth with it. Just on account of its hardness, it cuts a ring into the rock, and the core goes up inside a barrel, and then you pull the rods out and take that core, and of course you study the rocks.
Can you go to considerable depth with that?
Yes, you can go to, of course, the deeper you go, the more expensive it becomes. But there are holes in the rand that will go down 6 to 8, maybe 10,000 feet.
What is that? Is this Witwatersrand? Rand?
Yes, they call it the rand down there, R-A-N-D.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Witwatersrand in South Africa. No, we use it at Homestake right along in putting out many, many holes, really hundreds of holes, in the mine from the successive levels, usually exploring the level with horizontal drill holes.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be anything 100 feet up to perhaps 1,000 feet. But those are all relatively short holes.
And then, of course, when the core comes out, you can tell exactly.
Yes, then the geologists map the geological structure from the cores, and when they get some mineralization, that's always assayed for, in our case, for gold. And that's all plotted on a map. And we're completely confident about those cores and those assays. It's a very precise technique that you use.
Is there any move to taking such core samples or prospecting for gold undersea?
Yes, and not for gold, there's been some amazing coring done on the floor of the ocean, but mostly, so far, largely for scientific purposes. And whether or not there'll be commercial production from under the seas is very doubtful. About the only chance for gold, I think, would be where you have gold accumulated in beaches that have now been submerged by a rise of the sea. You see, gold tends to accumulate in the washed sands of a beach, just the way gold tends to accumulate in the gravel of a river. It's so indestructible, and it's so heavy that with constant washing of the waves and constant washing of the current of a river, you'll get gold accumulating in along the bottom of a river, as it did in California. That was the poor man's gold I referred to. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes where a river carrying gold in its gravel hits the seas, the gold will be concentrated by the washing of the waves. Those rich gold, for example, on the beaches at Nome, that was the in Alaska that led to that great Nome rush. And the Geological Survey has been spent a lot of money on studying the possibilities of a submerged beach off that coast, if there is, it'd be almost hopeless job to try to mine it in that water. It's rather a strange thing that where the Treasury was saying, oh, we have so much gold, we don't need more gold, another arm of the government is spending tens of millions to try to find more gold.
Very curious.
But there's the possibility of resources of metals on the floor of the ocean in nodules, in these peculiar chunks of materials still very hard to explain, which contain manganese, some of them contain phosphates, and there are even some that have nickel and quite another number of other rare elements. But for the most part, those have been right on the seafloor itself.
Are they lumps?
They're just lumps, yes. Sometimes tiny pellets, or sometimes lumps perhaps a couple of feet in larger dimensions. But whether or not those could be recovered and you could make a profitable mining industry out of them is very uncertain. On the other hand, if you look at the long-range future and say the time may come when the resources of the land are exhausted, I think it's highly probable that devices would be found for scraping these things off the bottom of the sea and recovering the metal from them.
Are they volcanic in origin?
No, it's really in some ways, I'm sure, a segregation from the seawater.
From the seawater?
The seawater contains everything, really. All the detritus that's washed from the land in solution in the rivers, and it gets into the sea. Of course, all this nonsense today about pollution, there's always been the degradation of the continents. The sea is the residual place where all these things collect. When you get down to atoms, you can probably find all the atoms of the periodic table in the ocean. There's gold in the ocean, but it's in such dilution you can't mine it. Magnesium is about the only metal that's really being recovered from the seawater today at a profit.
Well, there's so much about mining that I want to ask you about, but I don't want to leave the monetary problems until
that's
you had your chance to say.
Well, I really am not an expert in it all. I would just end up with that by saying that I do think that gold is the best hope to have a common money for the world if gold were properly used as the basis for the worldwide monetary system. And I would like to see coins created again, because coins have a great hold on men's imaginations, and they're beautiful, and it's a very nice device. People certainly are not going to go around with a great pocket full of gold coins, but they ought to have the right to, and if you can go in and get gold coins for your paper at any time, well, you'll have much more confidence in that paper. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to see an old gold coinage monetary system reestablished. The Africans are putting out a very interesting new coin.
Oh, really? It's which called, country is this?
It's South called South Africa.
Oh.
It's called a Kruger Rand.
K-R-U-G-E-R.
After the old President Kruger.
Oh, yes.
And their monetary system is called the Rand, R-A-N-D. And the Kruger Rand, however, is a one-ounce coin guaranteed to contain 1 ounce of gold and no specification in the monetary unit.
Now, when you say no specification in the monetary unit...
They call it a Kruger Rand, but it's not specified as so many runs, or it's not specified as so many dollars. It's as if we published, as if we created a coin here about the size of the $20 gold piece and just labeled it 1 ounce of gold.
I see.
So these are labeled 1 ounce
of gold.
And their value, of course, would depend upon for the time being. This is so-called free market for gold.
At the moment, do you know what its equivalent would be?
They write it up arbitrarily at 8% over the free market. Or over I don't like to use the term free market, over the market, the available market. And they're selling in very substantial quantities.
Now, is it legal for an American citizen to own a Kruger Rand?
I don't think so.
I see.
I don't think we could buy them.
I see. Now, when it says this has 1 ounce of gold,
yes.
What other metal then
is it? The gold is too soft to put out in pure gold form. So the monetary gold is usually about 90% gold and 10% copper. They express it in carats, which is a silly way of doing it. Percent is much better. But the copper gold alloy is the coinage alloy, which is relatively hard and still preserves the beautiful luster of gold.
Oh yes. Well, how did the carat weight become?
I don't know. Let's see. Diamonds and gold are in carats. I think it's just part of the talent for the English in creating complicated systems.
I see.
Oh, it's part of the silly old device using 24s and 12s and those numbers that can be divided easily into quarters and so on, rather than our present in the decimal system, leads to something like carats.
Right. Now, in addition to this Kruger Rand, which sounds fascinating, are there other nations creating gold coins in the same fashion?
I don't think so. There was some Italians some years ago put out a lot of gold sovereigns, and of course that was regarded, there was suit brought against them, it was quite illegal, that they were exonerated on the grounds that the sovereigns they put out were honest and that they had a full amount of gold in them.
Hmm.
But I don't know just what the outcome of that suit was. But apparently, I don't think there are new coins being put out in any public way, at least. I wouldn't be a bit surprised though that there were coins, some of the old coins being reproduced. And if they have the honest amount of gold in them, is that counterfeiting?
Yes, what is counterfeiting, actually?
Of course, from an artistic standpoint, from a collector's standpoint, you could say it was counterfeiting when the value perhaps depended upon the fact that it was an old coin. Let's say, take an extreme case, if you counterfeited a coin of the period of Alexander the Great, that coin would have immense value as a museum piece. And a reproduction of it might have the same value of gold, but if you couldn't tell them apart,
Well, this suggests all sorts of interesting illicit opportunities.
Oh, it does. It really does.
Now, a gold, what is it called? Bullion? Is in
bullion, yes.
Little blocks,
yes.
Little bricks?
We, you have to put out a bullion of a certain quality for the market. We have a refinery right at the mine, and it was a refinery using a process called a chlorination process, and we were putting out gold of 997, and gold that's perfectly good for most jewelry purposes and things of that sort, and meets practically all the purposes. But the electronic industry wants 0.99999, 4 nines, fine. Oh. So we put in an electrolytic refinery now, and we turn out the gold of the high purity for, so we can give the market anything it wants.
I see. And is this, are these little blocks very heavy? Is that the?
Oh yes, gold's very heavy. These
so
are
your
blocks.
Hands are about, what,
oh,
18 inches apart?
Yes, about like that. I'll send you some of the technical things on that sometime if you'd like to see them.
Yes, it's certainly fascinating.
And we sell these gold bricks directly to the consumer.
And about how much would that weigh, one of these 18-inch bricks?
Let's see, what do our things weigh? I suppose about 30 or 40 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I really should know all those
inventions,
but I keep forgetting them. But it's quite a sight to see the gold poured into these bricks.
Oh,
you see, we turn out about 600,000 ounces of gold a year. That would be 6 times 35 at the monetary price, given the value of it to London. Pretty close to $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
But every dollar of the price of gold helps.
Yes.
Every dollar means 600,000 more in the gross return.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can see that. Of course, in the Pacific Northwest, we saw, the little lumps out of the streams.
Oh, yes,
the
nuggets.
The nuggets on
yes.
the watch chains.
Yes,
that
oh, lots.
That was my first.
People knowledge. Love those.
Yes, they're odd little things.
Yes. Well, they're the fragments of gold, you see, that occurred in veins and in the solid rock, and as the mountains were worn down, they accumulated in the streams, and they were rolled and pounded, buffeted by the boulders and the gravels until they get into these little nuggets,
mm-hmm.
or get down to fine little specks of gold, flower gold, tiny little grains of gold.
Oh yes.
They're probably much more, well they are much more, that's the sort of thing you wash out on a stream, these tiny little specks and flakes of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you get a nugget, so much the better.
Right. it's so nice and tangible. That
yes, they're rarer.
The pleasure of this.
Yes.
Well, perhaps we could just barely begin the homestake. And there's so much to say about so much that I would love to hear about.
Did you get a chance to look over the book a little bit?
Yes, I did. And it gave me several ideas that I would like to pursue with you. One, some of the events, external events that transpired during the time that you had responsibilities at Homestake, including depression, stock market decline, the war, and so on. And then possibly some of the problems of fire, water, unionizing, fallen rock, and the problems of actually pursuing them. I might just ask you about one thing just to begin with. When you came into the Homestake Mine, was it 1925?
Yes, it was 1926 was the first summer I was up there as a consultant. And they had, at that time, a very erroneously pessimistic view about the future of the mine. The ore bodies, as they were being followed down this series of folds in the ancient rocks were not very well deciphered and worked out, and certain individual bodies played out, and they didn't realize there were others coming in.
Was this Lawrence Wright and Arthur Yates who?
Yes. Well, Lawrence Wright was the geologist up there when I went up at that time. He had a very pessimistic view, and he was a rather a limited person in his geological background.
Yes,
he really was not much of a geologist.
I see. And you were still on the faculty at Harvard.
Yes. Yes. That was after I. That first summer, my old friends in Peru, the manager, wanted me to come back to Peru for the summer to make a particular study of a mine that they thought they might acquired. I wish, well, it would have been very interesting to have gone back, and I wanted to. I think they would have acquired the mine if I had gone back. They didn't do it. It was a mistake. It was the Huaron mines.
How do you spell that?
H-U-A-R-O-N. But Mr. Edward Clark, who was the president of Homestake at that time, and also president of Cerro de Pasco, of both companies, said that they wanted a study made of the Homestake. They thought the Homestake was through, it was approaching its end, but they'd better want to have somebody take a look at it and really see if that was the situation.
So he robbed Cerro de Pasco to pay Homestake.
So I left Cerro de Pasco and went to Homestake, and I've been mostly with Homestake ever since. But I felt from the first thing out there that they were just improperly pessimistic about the future of the mine. You can see from that book how George Hirst really created that company by realizing that he had to acquire everything he could get out there. He put it all together. And if a lot of little individual companies had started to mine that great ore body as separate operations, none of them would ever have amounted to very much. And George Hirst had the concept to put it all together, mine it on a big scale, it'll be a very great mine. And he created the company and created the enterprise, and he deserves the first credit. The man who staked the original Homestake claim that gave his name to the mine, to the company, was just one of a half dozen who had staked claims all over that hill. That one claim was not the Homestake mine, but it was the first one Hirst bought, and he paid a very decent price for that one claim. And in his 2 years up there, he really put things together. But then their first concept was to mine on a big scale and get low costs and so on. And I know that the impression grew that it was a great low-grade mine. Well, it was a great high-grade mine. But for years, they failed to recognize just how the gold was distributed in these folded rocks, and they simply mined everything that came. So the material that went to the mill was low grade. It was quite profitable, but they were turning out a small fraction of the gold that could have been made if they could find their mining strictly to where the gold was.
Would their technology at that time have permitted this sort of selective?
Probably not. That is, the geology was quite obscure. It took a lot of very careful mapping and study to know how these ore bodies were distributed. They're in very ancient rocks that are very highly folded, and to use the geological term, metamorphosed. Mm-hmm. They're old sediments metamorphosed into slates and phyllites and schists and rocks of that sort, so that you don't easily see the structure of the original folded beds. And yet it was the structure of these original folded beds, and particularly the one bed that contains practically all the gold, that gave the key to the distribution of gold in this big zone. And a geologist, the United States Geological Survey, Sidney Page, published the first bulletin out there in which he emphasized the sedimentary structure, but he didn't have opportunity to map in the great detail that was necessary to make it a useful concept, but he deserves credit for recognizing that there was one folded bed high in gold. Not high in gold, but in which all the gold was confined to that one bed. The bed goes for miles, but right in the vicinity of the mine, practically all the ore is in that bed. So it's highly important to get that carefully mapped in the mine workings. There were two men up there, Wright and Hosted, who worked with Sidney Page, but neither one of them really had the geological background necessary to carry on very well. When I went up there, I got hold of Arthur Yates, who was a graduate from Berkeley, mm-hmm. the son of the superintendent, and I couldn't really get any place with Wright. He just didn't know enough. And Yates became enthusiastic about it. He went on for 2 years carrying on this careful mapping that I wanted done. And it really made possible the more careful and selective mining that changed the grade of the ore that we sent to the mills from about $4 in gold per ton to $8, which made a terrific difference. And then along came Roosevelt, who increased the price of gold from $20 to $35, and it all coincided. So Homestake, in that particular period, had enormous benefits of increasing their grade from better mining and then having Roosevelt increase the price of gold. Roosevelt got all the credit.
But at least
well, not all. I think we've got plenty of credit out of it.
But the presidents have not always done you dirt then.
No, he didn't, in spite of the fact that I don't admire him. He really helped us. He did the right thing at the time in increasing the price of gold, but for the wrong reasons.
I see. A curious situation. I hate to stop, but I see we're coming.
Well, we probably better. That would be a good time to stop. You have an appointment. I'd better get over to it. See.